You can sing and recite the church's hymn book, the Psalms, using modern English and new musical settings in the new Concordia Psalter. Check it out at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase the Concordia Psalter by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Make the Concordia Psalter part of your devotional life this year. 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, the new Concordia Psalter. Remember it, not like it was yesterday, because it certainly wasn't yesterday. In my case, it was, oh golly, probably 35, 36 years ago. I was a teenager, barely a teenager, 13 or 14 years old, and we'd studied under the pastor in the parochial school, and then on Tuesday nights, if I remember, never paid much attention during confirmation class. Somehow, I think only out of the mercy of the pastor, found myself on Confirmation Sunday, there it was, Palm Sunday, with my white robe and getting my individual Bible verse and having my head patted, at least, or so I thought, by the pastor or the pastors at the time. And everyone was proud, and there were pictures taken, photographic evidence of the fact that I somehow made it through, despite the fact that I was, as I mentioned before, a teenage boy. Now, if I look back on it, I should not have been confirmed that day because, like I said, I hadn't been paying that close attention, but I was 13. It was time, and it would have been kind of messy not to confirm me, I think. I wouldn't have confirmed me, but that's what the experience of a lot of Lutherans is. Here comes Pentecost Sunday or Palm Sunday. The kids have reached that age, 13. They've sat in, well, more or less a year, 2 years, 3 years of class, it's time to confirm them. But what does that mean, to confirm these kids? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Monday, January the 19th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Joining us, we're going to begin a series with him on the history of confirmation, Pastor Mark Serberg. In the second hour of the program, we will conclude a series, our 11-part series on the Small Called Articles, with Pastor Paul McCain talking about monastic vows and human traditions, and the men who signed the Small Called Articles. Pastor Mark Serberg is pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Marion, Illinois, and he's author of a series of articles titled The Weird and Wacky History of Confirmation. Mark, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
That practice that I described there a moment ago, which I think is still kind of the common experience of many Lutherans today, they reach a certain age, generally 13, 14, somewhere in that neighborhood, early junior high. They go through some classes, they are confirmed, and they are communed for the first time. Where does that actually come from?
Well, what you're describing is so typical, and we all assume that it's just always been that way. But if you had have looked at the Lutheran Church through its history, you wouldn't find that particular form of confirmation the way it was experienced until the 1700s, in the age of rationalism, when most of the major elements you described actually come into being.
So let's delve into that and take that apart a little bit, if we could. What is rationalism, and how do its presuppositions go into forming, or perhaps we could say, in some sense, deforming the Church's historic practice of both confirmation and First Communion?
Well, rationalism was this intellectual movement which places reason at the center of all things, and the reason is the ultimate judge of things. And obviously, when you try to bring that into the life of the Church, there are quite a number of difficulties as you deal with God's revelation and things that, you know, go beyond reason. And so rationalism sought to shape the Church in ways that pertain to what reason could do. And so confirmation becomes something that is emphasized really at the expense of baptism, because while baptism in Lutheran doctrine is obviously this miraculous thing of God using water and the Word to create new spiritual life and forgive sins, confirmation of something in which people are saying things that they believe and now have come to understand is a very rational exercise. And so that becomes a focus along with these vows of commitment that you make, because now you are becoming sort of a full-fledged member of the church. The it becomes a family event that is sort of this celebration of coming of age and of youth, along with sort of a very individual emphasis. So the whole practice of receiving your individual Bible verse comes into being at that time. And the focus on the sort of the intellectual aspect is seen in the fact that the whole practice of the public examination, which we just kind of assume this is what happens, did not become extensive in the way that we've come to know it until the age of rationalism. And for the most part, it was not a separate event until the age of rationalism. So in all these ways, you see this sort of focus on an intellectual aspect of it, an individual aspect of it, and also a sort of a sentimentality about it. It's turned into this big event. You have special clothes or a robe, you know, the family meal. Most of what we kind of think of confirmation as being comes into being at this time. And in many ways, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with baptism. It doesn't really have to do with, you know, catechesis and development in the faith.
So it becomes, it goes from what it was before, which we'll talk about in a moment, into, and I think you even used the term a moment ago, into a rite of passage.
That's really what it fully becomes. I mean, there were, and of course, none of these things appear out of the blue completely. I mean, there you can look back in the history and find elements that are going to sort of lead to this. But this full-blown emphasis on this rite of passage, which, by the way, in the European education system, in Germany at that time, usually also coincides with sort of your finishing grammar school, and for many people, your finishing education. And the school year ended around Holy Week, and therefore Palm Sunday becomes this very, very common day to do your confirmations. And so those elements all get knit together in this very much sort of socio-cultural thing that the church takes on, and takes on in many ways, you know, a life larger than itself. The theological claims that Lutheranism would have ever made about confirmation are far outstripped by the way that people experience this thing.
Okay, and under the sway of rationalism, what became, or how was the relationship between, or the understanding of the relationship between confirmation as a rite of passage and First Communion? How did that change under rationalism?
Well, it's more so that now there's going to be this very large body of teaching that we are going to have mastered and know before we go to the sacrament. Like, the irony is that, of course, in the age of rationalism, it's also a time when, because that too obviously emphasizes the supernatural of Christ giving his true body and blood using bread and wine, the actual celebration of the sacrament diminishes in terms of how often it is celebrated. So it is this rite of passage that I'm going to enter into beginning to receive the sacrament, because now I have mastered this very large body of doctrine that I'm supposed to know. But once I've entered into that and I'm able to, the sacrament itself is not going to be a major thing in the life of the church either, because I just won't see it celebrated very often.
So what was problematic about this, kind of the co-opting of confirmation and First Communion under rationalist enlightenment? What was problematic about it?
Well, it put an emphasis on confirmation as an event, rather than putting an emphasis on reception of the sacrament and the ongoing development of catechesis. And of course, the more you emphasize confirmation as an event, kind of this terminal event towards which everything is directed, the more you give the impression that you're sort of graduating and moving on. And I think that is probably the gift, as it were, that is bequeathed to the Lutheran Church. And we all talk about, you know, you people graduate from the faith at confirmation. Well, in the age of rationalism, confirmation took on the form where it really is this full-blown event that comes at the end that says you've reached the point and now you can move on to other things.
So really everything that people worry about with respect to confirmation and the continued life of youth in the church today, everybody worries, once these kids are confirmed, we never see them again. I mean, how many times have we heard this?
Sure.
Comes from how, or at least in part, from how rationalism co-opted confirmation.
It certainly set it up in a way that is guaranteed to facilitate a lot of the problems we see. And I mean, obviously, the culture we live in is, you know, a challenge, and just the devil, the world, our own sinful nature, these are all issues. But it definitely sets it on a trajectory that can do nothing but create the problems that we have.
It was not always so. So how was it in the earliest life of the church? Where do we see there, and I know that it's deep within the history of the church, where do we see what we know today as kind of confirmation, although I don't know if the word would be used, instruction in the faith for the young leading to a profession of faith and a first communion, if those were even connected? Where do we first see this taking place in the church?
Well, the interesting thing is, I mean, if we're talking about youth or children, you know, this process up until the time of the Reformation, even up until the medieval period, is very, very different than anything, you know, we would imagine. In the early church, up until maybe about the, you know, the 6th century, with adults, you have the catechumenate, which is this process of bringing largely adults who are coming from a pagan background into the church. In terms of raising children in the church, you know, you basically have the teaching of very basic elements of the faith, you know, the Ten Commandments, the Creed, the Lord's Prayer. You have essentially catechesis that simply takes place by being at church, and your local priest is involved in some way in trying to see with the family that those three basic elements are sort of in some rudimentary way learned. The child's been baptized. First communion begins at a relatively early age through the medieval period. You know, it varies anywhere from, you know, 7 to 12. There's this this idea that you sort of have to have some, you know, intellectual ability. But it really is not a specific assigned age. It's much earlier than we would expect. And confirmation itself is largely unrelated to either catechesis or to first reception of the sacrament. It is instead a sacramental act by the bishop that infuses and brings this additional grace that you need for living the Christian life. And the strange thing to us, at least, is that you know, the evidence from the 14th and 15th centuries, right on the eve of the Reformation, indicates that it was in many ways the neglected sacrament, that many people were not bringing their children to be confirmed, and there's all kinds of evidence from church councils that they're frustrated by this fact.
We're talking with Pastor Mark Serberg, pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Marion, Illinois, and author of a series of articles titled The Weird and Wacky History of Confirmation, beginning a series with him on the history of confirmation. When we come back on this Monday afternoon, we will talk about how the Reformers took this practice, this rite, and how they attempted to keep it. Maybe that's all the more we can say. We'll be right back.
Classical Education 101. The principles of classical education are time-tested teaching methods used in select public, private, and charter schools across the country and fast becoming the preferred method for all parents. What about classical Lutheran education? What are these time-tested methods? Come to St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois on Saturday, January 31st at 9 a.m. For more information, call 618-633-2209.
Do you wish your Lutheran school offered Latin, Greek, or logic? What about German or calculus? Right now, local Lutheran schools in two different states are utilizing Wittenberg Academy to expand their course offerings. Whether it's Latin for third graders or logic for seniors in high school, Wittenberg Academy can help. For your homeschooler or for your brick-and-mortar Lutheran school, we have solutions. To find out more, visit wittenbergacademy.org.
The faith, once for all, delivered to the saints. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If your travels bring you to Northwest Indiana, the Saints of Heritage Lutheran Church in Valparaiso invite you to join us for a Christ-centered, cross-focused divine service at 9 a.m. on Sunday morning. For more information about visiting Heritage, please contact Pastor Joseph Ostafinski by calling 219-464-2810 or sending an email to heritagelc@frontier.com. You can also visit us on the web at www.heritage-lcms.org.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and lay people worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy promotes confessional Lutheran theology through conferences, scholarly exchanges, and publications like Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up for their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. lutheracademy.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin on this Monday afternoon, January the 19th. We're beginning a series on the history of confirmation. Pastor Mark Serberg is our guest. In hour two of the program, Pastor Paul McCain will join us to conclude our 11-part series with him on the small called articles of the Lutheran Confessions. We'll be dealing with the last two kind of bits of housekeeping that Luther kept there, his final thoughts on monastic vows. He's very sharp there. He says this should just be eliminated entirely. It's contrary to the chief and first article of the faith, and then human traditions as well, of which he says we'll have no part. And we have to sort out what exactly he was condemning there. That's hour two of Issues Etc. Mark, let's talk a little bit about something you mentioned briefly before the break, and that is we have confirmation kind of becoming, you said, a sacramental act disconnected from both First Communion and from catechetical instruction, wherein the bishop would visit, and I assume on rare occasion, would visit and bestow a certain kind of grace. Go deeper into that particular phase of confirmation's history.
Well, what had happened was that essentially in Roman baptismal practice, you had two anointings. One was by the priest, the presbyter, and the second one was by the bishop. When that system was imported largely during the 8th century into Gaul, what today is Western Germany and France and the Low Countries, what happened was you had baptism taking place in, you know, many, many sites in a diocese, in a whole area that a bishop had responsibility for. It wasn't possible for the bishop to be, you know, at all those locations every time a baptism was done. And so the baptism took place, and then later on the bishop would come in his travels, and this was supposed to be part of his ministry as a bishop, to go around and do confirmation in these places. Well, you have this separate thing, the bishop has to show up and anoint, and you need some kind of explanation or rationale for, you know, what's happening. And so the practice in some way sort of drives the theological reflection. And the belief is that in providing this anointing, the an additional sort of gift of the Spirit is being given, that is this increase of grace by which the believer is strengthened, so that then he can prevail and strive to live as a Christian in this world. And so it is this strengthening becomes the term that's applied all the time. It has kind of this odd history. We find it in a sermon attributed to a collection of documents that come, we think, from about the 5th, 6th century in Gaul. But it gets taken up into a collection known as Pseudo-Isidore's False Decretals, which in the 9th century was put together to sort of try to buttress bishops' responsibilities and claims, their sort of authority. And because it's in this collection, which is taken to be authoritative, you have this kind of bizarre string of events in which authoritative authors continue to take it up because it was in some other authoritative author. Gratian in the 12th century will take it into his Decretums, which will become the basic text for canon law. Peter Lombard takes it up into his Sentences, which will become the basic text of theology, and thereby it ends up in Thomas Aquinas, included in his writings. This central idea that because there's a second anointing, it's providing some additional strengthening for living the Christian life becomes, you know, the standard Catholic teaching of the medieval church, largely because it's been passed on either by being falsely attributed to popes that never existed or by being placed in collections that were falsely attributed to some, you know, author and given a certain sense of authority in doing so. And Aquinas, of course, would have had no idea that this was the case. He actually quotes it as being from a Pope Melchiades, who never actually existed. But that's how it ends up sort of within Roman Catholic teaching, or what would obviously later become Roman Catholicism, Catholic teaching at the time of the medieval period.
That's a really dubious history, isn't it?
It's a very dubious history, and even Roman Catholic scholars acknowledge this.
Okay, so that would leave the reformers, the Lutheran reformers in particular, in a bit of a pickle when they start doing liturgical and ritual reform, when they get around to thinking, what do we do with this thing, with confirmation? Were they aware of its dubious history, or did they, like so many, unwittingly simply assume that it was something that had a solid history and practice in the church?
They are not aware of, because simply the historical research and sort of unpacking of where these documents come from had not been done. So they really had no way of knowing the real history of confirmation. You find in someone like Martin Chemnitz this sense that there must be, you know, this is this venerable practice in the church. There must be some, you know, true understanding behind it. If we go back far enough, we'll have find the pure practice. So you do have that sense. The other reaction, though, was especially since confirmation was practiced at the expense of baptism, and obviously confirmation has no, you know, scriptural warrant, the one reaction was simply just do away with it. And so for Luther and those who were closely tied to his circle and their continuing influence in the church, and it's a surprise to us, that actually becomes the practice. There is no such thing as a rite of confirmation. And for most of the history of Lutheranism, up until the middle of the 18th century or so, that's the majority practice. There is no rite of confirmation.
So they just look at it. They say it must come from someplace, but we don't see from where, and we see no scriptural warrant for it, and we see abuses attached to it in the Roman Church. Why would we do this?
Why would we mess with the thing is kind of the reaction, yeah. I mean, when pressed, they might say, well, you know, laying on of hands and prayer, and, you know, there are certain things there that, you know, aren't inherently bad. But the focus of the thing is not biblical, it's not true, and why do we need it?
What did they do? I mean, they don't abandon instruction, they don't abandon First Communion.
No.
What if we, and what you've required us to do here, Pastor Serberg, is to recognize the distinction between the rite of confirmation as it was in medieval church history and the genuine biblical need for instructing the young in the Christian faith and bringing them to the altar of Christ and putting them in mind of their baptism, all of those things that the church needs to do. How did they sort it out?
Well, obviously, the Lord's baptismal mandate is to make disciples by baptizing and teaching. And so the distinctive emphasis of Luther and the Lutherans who followed in his train was the emphasis on catechesis itself. I mean, obviously, you see in the writing of the small catechism, the large catechism, the development of schools, you know, they have this very, very strong emphasis on catechesis, and both catechesis at home and also catechesis at church. So, it's assumed that the small catechism is going to be, you know, it's described as the layman's Bible, you know, that this is the summary of everything you need to know about the faith, and so this will be something that will be taught at home. Within the church setting, they have catechetical services, And then also certain seasons of the year when catechetical sermons were preached, especially like in Lent, and some of those, you know, helped to form the basis later of what became the large catechism. So in that process between home and what's happening at church, children are being exposed to the faith. They're being taught the chief parts of the faith and learning about it. And then the basic practice is when parents who are assumed to be, you know, the primary caregivers and the ones who chiefly, you know, are the one, the head of the family to teach the faith to the children, when they come to a conclusion that the child is mature enough and has an understanding and a grasp of what's going on, they would bring the child to the pastor, and the pastor would examine in private the child, usually with the parents there, to go through basically, you know, the chief teachings that we find in the small catechism, and having seen that they have a handle on, you know, those six basic parts, and certainly a knowledge and understanding it to discern the body and blood of Christ in the sacrament, they would begin communing. They would then also continue on in the process of catechesis, because it's assumed the catechesis continues at home, and these catechetical services continue at church, and the sermons continue, and so it is not you reach this point and you're done. It rather is you're much younger, and you begin receiving the sacrament, and then you just continue to be taught. One of the things to recognize, though, this is a much younger age than, you know, we would assume. So, you know, to be doing this as an 8-year-old is completely normal in that setting. It's not a matter of waiting until I'm 13, 14, whatever. It's just simply if I am able to understand what the small catechism has to say, and I can know the text of the Ten Commandments and the Creed and the Lord's Prayer and, you know, the words of institution, the baptismal text, then, you know, examined by the pastor, I'm ready to begin communing, and I begin that part of life in the church.
So they didn't disconnect instruction from First Communion?
Not at all. No, not at all.
But they did disconnect because they eliminated the rite of confirmation. They said, look, that has nothing to do with either of these things here. We're going to instruct toward First Communion, and we're going to instruct from First Communion. It's going to continue on for life.
Yes, and that's... Which, of course, you know, to us sounds really bizarre, at least at first. It's so different than what we've experienced. But I think it's helpful to recognize that for, you know, at least 150 years in much of Lutheranism, you know, that's what the practice looked like. And especially this emphasis on the fact that, you know, the specific age is not the issue. It's more the maturity and the ability to have a basic understanding of the faith, and especially an understanding of, you know, the gift that's being given, the sacrament, that's all that's necessary in order for someone to begin to receive the sacrament of the altar, which really makes, you know, good sense if you believe what Lutherans believe about the sacrament in terms of the body and blood of Christ for the forgiveness of sins and strengthening in the faith. And, you know, why would we not want, you know, those who can believe these things to receive it.
Pastor Mark Serberg is our guest. When we come back, how did, if it was for the sake of good order and for, if perhaps no other reason than they couldn't find a useful reason for keeping it, if confirmation was eliminated by the earliest Lutheran reformers as a rite, while they kept the emphasis on baptism, the instruction that followed that toward the Lord's Supper and lifelong catechesis, how did confirmation find its way back in? We're going to answer that question with Pastor Mark Serberg, beginning a series on the history of confirmation with him here on Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin.
Is there a time for different colors, different names you find it hard to spell? Is there a time for First Communion, a time?
Listen to the best of the Church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
What if we made it clear to the Sunday morning visitor that Jesus is actually present, forgiving sins? I've written the second part of my essay, Lord's Day, Lord's House, Lord's Supper, and you can read it in the latest Issues Etc. journal. Just click the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. The Wittenberg Trail feature details Pastor Eric Rapp's journey from the New Age through Methodist Pietism to Confessional Lutheranism, the free online Issues Etc. journal.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues Etc. journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Lord God, Thou hast made me a pastor and teacher in the church. Pastors know they aren't perfect, but they are to be cherished and supported. Learn more at acelc.net and register for our next conference on the unbiblical removal of pastors from the office of the ministry, February 10th through 12th in Kansas City, Missouri. Pastors aren't perfect, but they are a gift from God. Learn how you can support them at acelc.net.
I will certainly bring it all to destruction.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, you're listening to Issues Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Beginning a series on the history of confirmation, Pastor Mark Serberg is our guest. He's pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Marion, Illinois. He's authored a series of excellent articles titled The Weird and Wacky History of Confirmation. I highly recommend you read these. They are eye-opening, and you can read them at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. In Hour 2, Pastor Paul McCain concludes our series on the Small Called Articles. We'll take up monastic vows and human traditions and the men who signed the Small Called Articles. So it sounds like by the time we get to the Reformation, they have been able to sort out things properly in their teaching and their practice to reconnect catechesis to baptism and to the reception of the Lord's Supper and to emphasize lifelong catechesis. How does the rite of confirmation find its way back in then?
Well, what we've described thus far is the majority practice, and of that, you know, there's lots of scholarship that would agree on that point. Unfortunately, that's not the only practice that's out there. And so you do have, you have to remember, obviously, 16th century Lutheranism is not a monolithic entity. You have all these different regional churches, and, you know, they each have their own particular character. You do have some areas that will retain some form of a confirmation rite, a very, very conservative kind of view, such as in Brandenburg. The most important one, however, is in Hesse. And in Hesse, Bucer is called in, who, you know, holds this sort of weird relationship that he at times sounds Lutheran, but he's not really Lutheran. He is called in because they are having trouble with the Anabaptists, and he had already had trouble with the Anabaptists in Strasbourg, and they were charging, the Anabaptists were charging, that this idea of infant baptism creates an environment in which people just take the Christian life for granted and are not serious then about living as Christians. And so Bucer, rather than simply following, you know, the biblical model of saying that, you know, we continue to preach law and gospel and, you know, follow the apostolic model of, you know, that we exhort and admonish and kill the old man in that way, takes on confirmation as a tool that he can use to sort of fend off these accusations by the Anabaptists. And so he draws upon, and Erasmus had already sort of talked in this way, he really sort of creates a new model, which is where catechesis will take place first, and then it will lead to the rite of confirmation. And it's very important to understand that that does not look at all like at what had preceded in the medieval church. This is really something quite new. And when you are finished with this catechesis and you go to confirmation, there will now be this vow of obedience to Christ, and also this vow of obedience to the church. And that model gets introduced and will over time prove to be very influential. And it will especially prove to be influential because Pietism will take it up and pursue it. And Pietism, of course, this movement in the latter portion of the 1600s, especially associated with Philip Jacob Spener. Spener had come into contact with a confirmation rite, such as found in Hesse, when he was a pastor at Frankfurt on the Main. And in Pietism, they take this up, and they now view the confirmation process as a way of basically converting people again. They have this idea that the faith created in baptism, in essence, dies, and people need to be converted again, and then so the confirmation process becomes the way of sort of reconverting them into real Christians who are going to be, you know, really living parts of the church, and that in renewing their baptismal covenant, not even remembering what God did for them, but as if they have a part to play, they now renew this baptismal covenant, and confirmation becomes the event in which they can renew this covenant and announce, you know, their real confession of faith, even to the point of, instead of using, you know, the creed as you would have, the Apostles' Creed, which is the baptismal creed, you now have the practice, and this will sound very familiar, of having the youth, you know, write their own statement of faith. And it is via Bucer and Hesse and Pietism that confirmation as a practice really begins to make inroads into Lutheranism, and it's sort of present so that then by the age of rationalism, it will be taken up and expanded fully into Lutheranism sort of as we know it. And so it's really, it never entirely disappears, but it gets changed into a new model that Pietism latches onto and finds to be very useful for its understanding of the way Christian life works.
And that is every bit, I mean, please be honest here, that is every bit as bad as anything in medieval Roman Catholicism was doing with confirmation and the rite.
It is certainly turning it into this individual thing where it is my faith, my believing, and emphasis on, instead of the works that I do, the feeling that I have. It's doing the same thing in a different way, but it, you know, ultimately it is the same thing.
So talk a little bit about Pietism and how we really cannot overemphasize the virility of Pietism. I'm not saying it was good, but it was viral.
Yeah.
Not only in Lutheranism, but many confessions of faith, and the degree to which it has almost permanently shaped what we know today as the confirmation rite and practice.
Yes, that is not saying it too strongly. It has. This idea that, you know, I must personally now give a confession of faith, and by doing it, you know, at this moment in this way, I now make it real, as if in a sense it wasn't, you know, really mine before every other time I confess the creed along the way. And so this heavy emphasis on the subjective side of it, a downplaying of the objective content of it. And in addition, this actually, pietism is the beginning of the movement to push confirmation back in age. Because if you are looking to sort of turn people inward and reflect on their own personal state of faith and those kinds of things, you need them to be a little bit older to at least be able to be more self-reflective in that way. And so the trend that reaches its sort of culmination in rationalism in terms of pushing the age back when people are confirmed and receive communion for the first time actually begins in pietism.
All right, then that means, and here we're talking about butting two things up against one another. We started, or more or less started, with talking about where we got what we have today, and you said that can really be laid at the doorstep largely of rationalism. So bring those two things together. Pietism makes, it invents a new thing, and then again, what does rationalism has kind of bad...
Sort of all the bells and whistles that you associate with confirmation as a rite, and the way that it has established itself in the Lutheran psyche as something that is just quintessentially Lutheran. You know, your description at the beginning of the program was just excellent because it was just so typical. Most of what you described there, the form you described takes place and is created during the era of rationalism. The sort of the theology and the ethos behind it of now you're going to be really a Christian who really is going to confess this faith, and we're going to have you write out your own statement and those kinds of things, that sense of it, and I think, at least in my perception with confirmation today in much of the church, that's really what drives, you know, people's understanding of confirmation. That really comes from pietism. And so probably much of the theology of the way people think about it in terms of the faith comes from pietism. Most of the forms and the way it's been turned into this huge event comes from rationalism. But you put those together over the life of the church where people don't know anything else, and that is a very, very powerful combination.
Okay, so to recap here, if we can kind of use as our touchstones, baptism and the Lord's Supper with biblical catechesis joined to both kind of permanently for life. What do we end up with today in the current right and misunderstanding of confirmation, use of confirmation, that really does violence against a biblical teaching on baptism, on catechetical instruction, and on the Lord's Supper? How would you summarize it?
Well, I would say, obviously, you've lost the fact by having this complete emphasis on a terminal event. You have really worked against an understanding that catechesis is tied to baptism, that begins at baptism and runs through life, because you are every single year teaching the lesson that, you know, you reach a point and then you're really pretty much done. So that certainly runs counter to a biblical understanding. You're certainly, by putting this rite that takes place when you're 13 or 14 years old, and you are not going to receive the sacrament of the altar until then, you are teaching youths who, you know, from second, third grade on, anywhere there, certainly understand what the Lord's Supper is if it's being talked about in church and mentioned in preaching, and certainly are being told this is a good thing for life. You're teaching them they don't really need it because they can live all these years knowing what it is and knowing it's supposed to be a good thing, but they're not receiving it. So you're really teaching them a non-sacramental form of faith. And in many ways, I mean, you've created something in confirmation that swallows up First Communion. Now, it's part of it, but people don't refer to it as First Communion. People refer to it as confirmation. And so a non-biblical thing gives it the name and really receives the emphasis instead of, you know, the actual biblical gift itself.
Let's take another break, and when we come back, 10 more minutes with Pastor Mark Serberg. We begin a series with him today on this Monday afternoon, January the 19th, on the history of confirmation. He's pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Marion, Illinois. He's authored a series of articles titled The Weird and Wacky History of Confirmation. More with Pastor Mark Serberg on Issues, Etc. right after this.
Those beautiful notes were just the beginning of We Praise You and Acknowledge You, O God, Concordia Publishing House's debut CD collection from Pastor Stephen Starkey, one of the most significant Lutheran hymn writers of our time. For a limited time, save 10% when you use promotional code URA. Simply visit cph.org today. Lutheran thought, Lutheran substance, Lutheran music, brought to you by Concordia Publishing House.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe that traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the Church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. Some things never change. The gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the Church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
You can teach lay people theology. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu.
Repentance and forgiveness, sin and grace, law and gospel, more than cliches, real preaching for real people in need of hearing the real Christ. Christ for you and the divine service at St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, Illinois, where we gather every Saturday night at 6 and on the Lord's Day, Sunday mornings at 7:45 and 10. Look for the Church of the Neon Cross on I-55 between exits 30 and 33. Find us on the web, stpaullutheranchurchhamel.org. St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, where there is the forgiveness of sins, life and salvation for the people of God.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Pastor Mark Serberg is our guest. 10 more minutes with him, beginning our series on the history of confirmation on this Monday afternoon, January the 19th. So explain in the simplest possible terms, Mark, why it is that what we largely have today, and again, we're not talking about monolithic practice today either, but what we largely have today by way of both practice and a misunderstanding of confirmation, the rite and everything surrounding it, overshadows, if not obscures, both baptism and the Lord's Supper. Why is that such a dangerous thing for the church?
Well, for starters, in baptism, you are made part of the body of Christ. You are as much a member of the church as you can be. And so when we put confirmation in between baptism and the reception of the sacrament, and now you're a communicant member, we're undercutting, you know, what baptism itself has already made you, and we're also losing sight of the fact that, you know, the baptismal life is one that continues on throughout life, just as the life of catechesis is supposed to continue on throughout life. And there's not some terminal event at which now I move sort of on and beyond to something else. And then, especially in terms of the sacrament, by setting confirmation at a time when we do. Sort of the expectations that we have with it, we cut off our youth, our children, from the sacrament, the very thing that's meant to sustain Christians in the life of faith, and we are teaching them a non-sacramental life in the church, which is the exact opposite of what we claim to believe. And so in that practice, we are working against ourselves. I mean, it makes no sense.
If we were to, by some sort of wave of the magic wand, the proverbial magic wand, to restore a proper practice such as was deemed proper by the 16th century reformers, what would it look like in the church today?
I think it would look like, I mean, essentially you would have ongoing catechesis at church that would be taking place. You would have ongoing catechesis at home. You would have catechesis that takes place in the setting of worship and not completely isolated in the classroom. And you would have, you know, children as they were able to, you know the catechism and know its basic teaching and recognize the body and blood of Christ would begin receiving the sacrament. And then you would have catechesis that continues on and probably you know, in some more formal way, to sort of, we have a fullness of content we want our members of our church to understand. So it's not to say we wouldn't have continuing instruction at later ages, but we wouldn't, at the end of that, put some kind of rite that sort of announces you're done, you're finished, you don't have to worry about it anymore. And I think that would be the ideal model. And I think we would have a recognition that the knowledge that is required of a child in the family of a congregation to receive the sacrament is not the exact same knowledge that we want a mature adult, you know, member of the church to have. And we need them to be moving towards that full knowledge, and we need to teach them that full knowledge. But it's not necessary to have that full knowledge in order to begin receiving the sacrament. That certainly was not the understanding of the Lutherans.
Why did Luther and the other reformers emphasize the role of the catechism so strongly in all of this, in the home, in the church, in preaching, in the whole liturgical life of the church? Why was that so important for them to have a text that everyone was from which everyone was taught and which everyone learned?
Well, it's a tool that can take the teaching that we do need to know and can then be woven into the fabric of our life, that we have that as a constant touchstone. It is both simple and profound. You can't exhaust it, and yet, you know, a child can learn it. And there was this strong emphasis that teaching the faith had fallen woefully short in the medieval period, and to have a set body, a text that could be learned by the youngest child but would continue to be learned by the oldest adult, was essential to the life of the church. And to have that in all places, uniting the church in the same teaching that it is learning and believing together, you know, was going to be essential for the survival of the Reformation and the ongoing, you know, welfare of the church as a whole.
So all of the things that have come to be popularly associated with the rite of confirmation, again, painting with somewhat of a broad brush,
sure.
The course of instruction leading up to essentially a Sunday morning of graduation, with
yes.
even with graduation gowns, the writing of one's own creed, otherwise we don't really know if they understand it, or one's own profession of faith. And a lot of churches toss in a lot of stuff like a certain number of public service hours that need to be accomplished and recorded,
okay.
and all those things are a distraction from what it is Christ gives us in Matthew 28: make disciples, baptizing and teaching.
Yes.
are they pernicious? Are they not just a distraction, but are they also
well,
in and of themselves?
Many of them come from sources that are antithetical to Lutheran theology, and they come from those sources for a reason. They lead in directions that do not foster what we believe. And so to take them up and practice them is very likely, in most cases, to be unwittingly promoting a theology that you don't claim to believe.
Bottom line, do we need to get rid of confirmation as we know it today?
In an ideal world, I think it would be a good thing. I'm also realistic about how entrenched in the general consciousness of the Lutheran Church it is. I think probably the first place to start would be a movement, and it's already obviously ongoing, towards early communion, or I guess what I prefer to call first communion, that we begin our children in catechesis that actually starts when they're young. We're not waiting until they're in 7th, 8th grade, now we're going to shove it down their throat, that we have catechesis that is going on, and that they begin living in this sacramental life of receiving the Lord's Supper. Because in doing so, I think that will begin to change some of the dynamic of the way our congregations function and the way people experience the faith. And at least I hope it can begin moving us towards a different understanding of, if we're going to have confirmation, at least what confirmation is.
Pastor Mark Zurberg is pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Marion, Illinois, and he's author of a series of articles titled The Weird and Wacky History of Confirmation. Mark, thank you very much. I look forward to our next conversation on this subject.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Pastor Paul McCain, concluding our series on the small called articles. But of course, our conversation with him never really ends. We'll move on to something else, probably the treatise on the power of primacy of the Pope after we're done. But when we come back in hour two, we're going to take up the last two subjects that Luther dealt with in the small called articles in the Lutheran Confessions: monastic vows, which he said should be eliminated entirely because they are contrary to the chief article of the faith. We'll find out why he felt so strongly about that when we join Pastor Paul McCain on our series on the small called articles in hour two of Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues, Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Mount Zion Lutheran, Greenfield, Wisconsin; Pilgrim Lutheran, West Bend, Wisconsin; Messiah Lutheran, Lebanon, Illinois; Zion Lutheran, Accident, Maryland; Redeemer Lutheran, Jackson, Wyoming; Messiah Lutheran, Marysville, Washington; Trinity Lutheran, Millstadt, Illinois; Our Savior Lutheran, Houston, Texas; St. Matthew's Lutheran, Bon Terre, Missouri; Good Shepherd Lutheran, Lincoln, Nebraska; Hope Lutheran, St. Louis, Missouri; Trinity Lutheran, Austin, Texas; Good Shepherd Lutheran, Collinsville, Illinois; Luther Memorial Chapel, Shorewood, Wisconsin; Christ Lutheran, Oak Park, Illinois; Bethany Lutheran, Naperville, Illinois; and Emmanuel Lutheran, Dearborn, Michigan. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues, Etc. in your mission or advertising budget at our website, issuesetc.org. Click support. The Issues, Etc. 300.